Joe.
Wow, Joe.
Joe's got some stuff going on. You said you were going to cry.
Joe.
That was so sudden.
You cannot lose games in the NFL and still win.
One day I understand. One day go see the baby be born and come back. You're a Major League Baseball player.
Did I not tell you?
Yes, you did.
See, don't answer. These are rhetorical questions because you know I told you and you know I'm
not. Analytics don't work at all. They're just a crap to some people who were really smart, made up, and tried to get in the game because they had no talent.
This kid is a gamer. He's a follower. He's a playmaker and a shot caller.
In case you didn't know,
I got T-Bowed. He shattered the mold. And all he does is win. All he does is win.
Hello and welcome to Hot Takedown 538 Sports Podcast. I'm Chadwick Matlin, an editor at 538, and with me in the studio, it's Neil Payne, sports writer, sports editor extraordinaire. Hello, Neil.
Hey, Chad.
Neil, the Mets posted an Instagram this week. It's a photo of Tim Tebow, tongue quarter out, and they want you to know, Neil, that Tim Tebow continues to improve. He had his first multi-hit game of the fall.
Wow. You know, I'll believe anything at this point, just about the world in general. So I, for one, accept our new Tebow overlord.
All right, excellent. I'm glad that Donald Trump has convinced you of Tim Tebow. And with us across the sea, across the state, Kate Fagan. Where are you, Kate?
Well, guys, it's actually my birthday, and I have company.
Ah! Whoa!
So the reason I'm not there is simply because I had plans in Brooklyn, and I couldn't get back to them in time. So I wish I could tell you that I'm like at this super far destination, but I'm not.
Kate Fagan's birthday.
You should have just made up some far flung destination. We would have believed it.
Can we try that part again?
Yeah, let's do a retake.
Kate Fagan, of course, is Hot Takedown's transition chairwoman as we move into the new administration. So let's.
Well, am I Trump appointed?
No, you're the transition chairwoman. You're arranging Hot Takedown's new regime.
Oh, okay. So it has nothing to do with the Trump presidency necessarily.
Donald Trump didn't appoint you. That Hot Takedown did.
Okay, good.
So on today's show, last weekend, the NFL finally found some exciting games, and it was in part because of how many 2-point conversion attempts there were. We will discuss the state of the 2-pointer in the league and when it is right to go for it, if we have any new information now that the extra point is so far away. And then college football saw a crazy weekend of upsets. We will discuss the implications for which teams are likely to make the playoffs and a new sport to the Hot Takedown rotation, chess, because the World Chess Championship is happening. We will get a live report from the scene of the World Chess Championship from 538's executive chess attaché, Oliver Rader. And then a very special, very British, and very bittersweet Sig Dig at the end of the show. So stay tuned for all of you who, you know, have a little scrapbook of Joe Sykes's intonations, as all of us would do, because there's an ode to Joe at the end of the show here. Before we get going with the show, let's just take a second to note that Ahead of Their Time is soon going to be past its time.
Oh, Chad.
No,
four have aired.
It's evergreen,
it's
Chad.
It's going to live on your podcast app
forever. Four have aired. The fifth is coming this week. Neil, what should people look forward to hearing in their Hot Takedown feed?
We're going to talk about one of my favorite athletes of all time, Randall Cunningham, who sort of changed the way people looked at quarterbacks, both in the sense of how they look, one of the first great black quarterbacks in the NFL, but also arguably the greatest mobile quarterback, certainly the best dual threat quarterback of all time if you combine rushing and passing. So we're just going to look at his influence on the game and how, you know, the role of the quarterback was never quite the same after him.
All right, so Cunningham this Friday, and then Ahead of Their Time mini season is on hiatus.
Going on hiatus.
All right.
Neil, do you promise to next week rank your favorite Ahead of Their Times in order?
Sure, why not? I could do that right now if you wanted to.
Well, what I hope Randall Cunningham is first.
What are the I guess we'll have to see how Randall's episode kind of performs in the ELO and then sort things out from there.
Okay, so ELO will make an appearance as
but
well.
But I will say that I think it's fair to say the biggest thrill of the entire first season of Ahead of Their Time was speaking with Randall Cunningham for about 45 minutes the other day. Cool. Very exciting.
Cool.
Wow.
Stay tuned.
The 10-year-old me was very excited.
All right, great. I look forward to hearing it. And listeners, you can hear it yourselves on Thursday in the Hot Takedown feed. Keep an eye out. All right, shall we talk about football, folks?
Yes.
Thank you for that resounding response. In a season that has been lacking a lot of excitement, I think, in an NFL season, the season that's been lacking a lot of excitement, there were a few really great, exciting games this past Sunday, one of which was the Seahawks-Patriots game, which ended with a great goal line stand, or at least was decided by a great goal line stand. There was a Broncos game that was decided on a blocked extra point that was returned for, do you call it a two-point conversion? When it's returned,
I believe
like
so.
That?
Mm-hmm. I believe so. Yeah,
a 2-point conversion, and then the marquee game was the Cowboys and Steelers. The Steelers have now lost 4 straight after losing to the Cowboys. Perhaps part of that are the 4 2-point conversions that they went for. Let me just run you through the 2-point conversions, then we'll play the take, and then we'll get into whether this makes sense. Pittsburgh attempted a 2-point conversion after its first touchdown against the Cowboys. It was no good, incomplete pass. Then, to make up for that, they attempted another after their second touchdown, also failed. Then, a third after taking a 24-23 lead. So perhaps there you're saying, let's get, you know, where a field goal ties it up. And that's midway through the fourth quarter where you do have to start considering some of those clock management questions. And there was sort of a miscue, and that was incomplete. And then in the game's final 8 minutes, they failed on another 2-point conversion that would have extended a 1-point lead to 3, so same as the last situation. So let's hear a take first, and then we'll get right to it. This is Adam Schein from Mad Dog Sports Radio.
Mike Tomlin was one of the MVPs for the Dallas Cowboys. Mike Tomlin going for 2 at any point in the first, second, and third quarter is a foolish, irresponsible, egotistical, selfish play that hurts the Pittsburgh Steelers. Mike Tomlin 0-for-4 going for 2. Here's a thought. Kick the damn extra points. I don't want to hear the percentages. Don't throw them at me today. It's a bad play when it works. It's a bad play when it doesn't work.
Guys, we really came through with a good hot take there.
Yeah, that was hot.
Kate, how are you feeling about that hot take?
Okay, it was. I grew up listening to The Fan and a lot of Mad Dog Radio, so it felt like my childhood, actually, Chad. But here, I think before we even dive into all of the issues around the issues, not in a negative way, but all of the questions and everything around the 2-point, can either of you, because I like to be inclusive now, Chad, I don't just want to ask Neil, can we illuminate what the right time is to not kick the extra point and to go for 2? Like, I know he doesn't even care what the numbers say, but I would love to know, is this kind of like if every football coach in the U.S. really wanted to play by the numbers, like nobody would even punt on fourth down. They would just use all 4 downs. But so what do the numbers actually say about when you should go for 2?
Yeah, to further your question, Kate, one of the things that Shine jogged in my mind was, does it matter when in the game a coach is going for 2? Because his point was, especially in the first 3 quarters, you don't want to go for 2. But it seems to me like a 2-point conversion might just be a 2-point conversion as far as percentage goes, as far as the likelihood to get it right. And so should coaches be changing their strategy in the fourth quarter?
Yeah, I mean, if I had to kind of guess off the top of my head, and I haven't seen any hard research on this about when to do it in the course of a game, I would almost think that you should be bolder on 2-point tries earlier in games, because we know that the percentages being what they are, that you should be at worst kind of indifferent whether you go for 2 or kick the extra point. And given the percentages this season, and we'll get into those also, that you have more expected points from a 2-point conversion than from an extra point if things are kind of, you know, holding up the way they seem to have held up since they moved the extra point yard line back. So all of that kind of being equal, you would probably want to do the kind of risky strategy, or more risk-laden, I think, strategy of going for 2 probably early in the game, and then when things kind of tightened up, kind of selectively choose what made sense given the context of the score late. That would be my guess, but again, I haven't seen any kind of real research on it.
And another thing that was in the take that stood out to me was this concept that Mike Tomlin's ego was the reason that the Steelers were going for two, as in because he was doing something, I guess, against the grain, that he must be doing it to call attention to himself. I think that actually comes into play. I mean, I think Chip Kelly, although there's a lot of issues around Chip Kelly, the reason everything seems to land on him is because whenever people thought that his offense was innovative, that for some reason it must be about building up his grandeur as a coach because he's not just following the status quo.
Well, and Kate, we've talked on this show before about how coaches' incentive to take risk is really off because they are basically paid not to make mistakes as opposed to take chances and then win because of those chances. Because if they take a chance and it backfires, and there's an easy reason to fire them. And I think that comes into it, where when a coach does take a risk, here's Adam Schein saying he's foolish, irresponsible, and yes, egotistical. But we should note, too, that the Steelers have a real history of going for two. In 2015, they set, I believe, a record for the number of twos that teams have ever gone for. And I wondered if maybe Tomlin's gotten snowed over by small sample size a little bit, where it's like, oh, last year we went 8 for 11. Maybe that means, like,
we're good at this.
We must have a good play set or whatever.
Yeah, and I don't think you'll ever really have, like, enough of a sample of two-point conversion tries to know for sure whether it was, you know, deviations from that league average of 50%, or I guess 54% this year, is due to some kind of particular strength of your team and your play calling in those situations, and how much of it is just luck. I think, you know, for the most part, given the small samples, we can say it's luck. The other thing I wanted to say about the ego aspect of it is maybe there's something to that, in the sense that it did seem like Tomlin was calling subsequent two-point attempts to make up for previous two-point failures. And in some sense, maybe that is kind of like a fallacy of, you know, sort of like to save face as a coach. After making one mistake, you kind of double down on it to try to make it all up in one try, because, you know, one...
You had to take one extra stop on your road trip, so now you're going to go an extra 15 miles an hour or something.
Right, yeah, exactly, to make up for it. That's a good analogy, Chad. And so that's the only way I could think of it, as being egotistical on the part of a coach to go for two. But mainly, it's just, you know, sometimes you flip a coin and four straight tails come up, you know? It just happens sometimes.
But shouldn't you, if you are a team that does go for two, shouldn't you be somewhat consistent about it? Isn't there a value in doing that more frequently than just attempting to pick your spots?
Yeah, because it is all about the long game, right? Like, it's about if you think that you have kind of an edge on whatever the expected value of a one-point try is, you would make that up over such an astronomically large number of attempts, you know, or over the course of a whole season or something, that you really have to be in it for, like, commit to it before the first week of the season and stick with it for a long time.
And maybe
time.
That's what Tomlin has done.
And maybe
basically.
That is what Tomlin has. So, we'll see how he reacts to the backlash this
week. It'll be another fallacy if he then goes way too far to the other poles. So,
right.
So let me – you talked about expected points. The number of two-point conversions have gone up since the extra point was moved back 13 yards.
As you would expect.
As we would expect. And what's interesting is that the percentage of successful two-point conversions have gone up in the same time. And so basically it's even – as far as the expected points that you would expect now, between kicking an extra point, about 95%, and getting a two-point conversion, which is about 47%. But, of course, you multiply that by two, and all of a sudden you're at 94.
And it should be pointed out that was kind of the ratio last year between the two. If anything, this year it swung, and again, we don't know if this is noise or something real. It's a difference of about five successful extra point or two-point conversions in the first 10 weeks of the season versus last year, that now the success rate this year is 54%, which does make it, if that is a, you know, believable percentage for the whole league, and of course it varies team by team, that would make sense to go for two every time, if that's true, if you can kind of more than break even by going for two and get the same number of expected points.
I'm also wondering, from an entertainment standpoint, if the NFL, or if we think even here, that the change for the extra point, moving it back and making it a live play, has taken care of the issue of making it like a valuable, meaningful play, and also introducing some level of, I guess, suspense for the viewer, because it's not just an automatic extra point kick. I mean, because that's obviously the whole point of all this. And I'm wondering if we think 94% conversion when the teams go for it for the extra point versus whatever those number were that you were just saying right there, near like 55% converting so far this year, roundabout on 2 point. Like, has that introduced a level of dynamic play that we think is like the sufficient entertainment value?
Well, what's interesting too is that the number of blocks have gone up this year on extra points compared even to last year.
We've seen a lot of the old hurdling the snapper and
people really get fired up about that.
Yeah,
it's an exciting play. Not a football play, but like they I saw a lot of people commenting. A lot of people. I don't know how significant that is, but there are people who believe that you shouldn't be allowed to hurdle the snapper, and that you should do it the old-fashioned way, which is you got to go through them, okay, or around them. You can't jump over them.
Yeah, I love it. I actually love that play. I don't know how safe it is, and I wonder, you know, why teams don't do it more. There must be some kind of reason why you don't see it all the time. But I think anything that you can do, to your point, Kate, about making the game a more exciting product.
And if I can offer my own metaphor here, because Chad offered such a valuable one earlier. It's kind of like the NFL saw that like they had an apartment and they weren't using all the space correctly. And then they decided we have to use every inch of this 800 square foot apartment. And now they've introduced into this nook or cranny or however you want to think of it, this switch to the extra point, which at least now provides like valuable real estate within the game.
We should note though that fewer people are coming to the house. Ratings are down. And so perhaps...
Well, they went up slightly after the election ended.
That's true. All right, let's leave it there and move on to a word from our sponsor. Hot Takedown this week is sponsored by Blue Apron. Yes, you've heard me talk about Blue Apron before. It is the service that will send you pre-portioned ingredients so that you can make delicious meals on your own time. Blue Apron has established partnerships with over 150 local farms and can be delivered to 99%. Of the continental U.S. And it's only $10 per person per meal. So you can stop spending so much money on eating out or at high-end grocery chains. What are you going to get for those $10 per person per meal? You can make things like this month. Pan-seared chicken with roasted fall vegetables and butter caper sauce. Spicy lotus root and purple carrot stir-fry with sweet potato noodles and lemongrass roasted pork with Romanesco cauliflower and coconut rice. New recipes are created weekly and are not repeated within the year. You can customize the recipes each week based on your preferences, and each meal comes with a step-by-step, easy-to-follow recipe card and pre-portioned ingredients that can be prepared in 40 minutes or less. So check out this week's menu and get your first 3 meals for free with free shipping by going to blueapron.com/takedown. You're going to love how good it feels and tastes to create incredible home-cooked meals with Blue Apron. So do not wait. Go to blueapron.com/takedown. Blue Apron, a better way to cook. Okay, now back to football, the college variety this time. Was it last week that we talked about college football and we went through the model, right?
We did go through the model, yes.
So, since then,
all hell broke loose
has arrived in college football. So, 3 of the top 4 playoff teams lost last weekend, all in really surprising games, essentially. Clemson lost to Pittsburgh by 1 point on a field goal in the final 6 seconds of the game. Washington lost to USC, ending a 12-game winning streak for Washington, and Michigan lost to Iowa on a 33-yard field goal in the last seconds of the game. Only Alabama prevailed.
Because, of course, they did. They've won by 48.
So if you're interested in reading about the excellence of Alabama college football, there's a great piece in the New York Times by friend of Hot Takedown, Mark Tracy, this week. Before we get to what the new odds say the playoff might look like at the end of the year, Neil, how crazy was that weekend historically? It seems like that was a particularly nutty one, but is it like the nuttiest ever?
It was one of the nuttiest ever. So we have big surprise for longtime 538 followers and listeners. We have an ELO rating model for college football that can give us probabilities of, you know, upsets and things before every game that's played. That we have that going back to 1936, the first year of the AP poll. So I decided to kind of dig into that and look for weeks of the season that contained the most shocking kind of group of losses for teams in the top five of the AP poll and the top 10 of the AP poll. And I found that 2016 week 12, that was this past weekend, ranked third craziest if you kind of add up the improbabilities of all of the upsets of
Wake
the top
me up when
10
we
teams.
See history, Neil. Right. Third craziest.
Third craziest.
You want me to get fired up about third craziest?
And, yeah, and the fourth craziest if you look at the top five teams. So, for instance, in 1990, there was a situation in which four of the top five teams lost on the same day.
Those were that was when
those
America
were
was
the
great.
Those were the days. Yeah. That's right. Yeah. And there were some crazy weeks in 2011 and 2008 that also were up there. But I mean, this one ranks right in that group in terms of the upsets. Clemson was, according to our model, in excess of 90% likely to beat Pitt. They ended up losing, like you said. And then Michigan and Washington were both greater than 75% chance to win their games. They lost. And so, yeah, I mean, this was one of the wilder shakeups. And it also kind of broke up this nice little neat group of four undefeated major conference teams that the committee was probably hoping that they would kind of continue to slide through. Or if, say, you know, one of them had to lose, it would be Michigan losing to Ohio State, and they could just kind of like slot the two for each other. Now you've got a bunch of one-loss teams below Alabama and some two-loss teams that
Clemson
have jumped into the conversation too.
So those one-loss teams, and then, Kate, I'll let you get in here. Those one-loss teams real quick are Clemson, Ohio State, Louisville, Michigan, Washington, West Virginia. Those are probably the contenders of those.
And what about like the two loss teams? You know,
like Colorado.
Yeah,
maybe.
Yeah.
I know where you're angling with these things, Kate. Yeah, I mean, Colorado, all of the two-loss teams benefited from what happened over the weekend, obviously, and now we just have a lot less certainty about who's going to make the playoff other than Alabama, who has this kind of really solid right. lock where they could probably lose certainly one game, and if they win the SEC, I think, you know, they would be locks to get in no matter what. But, you know, they have wiggle room. These other schools don't.
So let's go to the percentages, and we can keep this conversation going. So Alabama's now at 91% to make the playoff. This is with how many games left, Neil?
So two left in the regular season before the SEC title game. Now, one of those that should be noted is against UT Chattanooga, which is a non-FBS
school. Which is next weekend.
Our simulation
does not even entertain the idea
that they might lose.
Could lose. It literally says, sorry, we can't do that. Hit reset and start over.
It doesn't happen.
And then there's Clemson at 64%, down from 79% last week. So, you know, that loss 15 percentage points off. That's significant.
Yeah, but again, they also play in the ACC. The only other real team of note at the top of the standings there is Louisville, who also has one loss, but Clemson has that trump card over them in the fact that they beat them head-to-head. They're in the same division. Clemson, if they win out, is guaranteed to win their division and play in the conference championship game.
Yeah, I mean, we mentioned a few times so far, like Louisville and Ohio State. And it made me think in following Saturday's games and in knowing Louisville as a one-loss team, but perhaps, and Ohio State falls in this category too, perhaps having the strategic placement of that loss helping when it comes to the College Football Playoff Committee. I mean, that's kind of, as I was following on Saturday, I was like, if you had to structure a schedule, like and you don't always have control of all the variables, but if you're a college AD, there seems to be, and there's only been a couple years, and perhaps like numbers would dispel this, but there seems to be a perfect time to lose one game if you're going to lose a game if you're not Alabama, and it seems to be in like week three or week four,
mm-hmm.
because you don't want to lose on opening week because that's just bad for your team. Although you certainly could, but you could certainly come back and be, you know, 12-1 at this point, and certainly be back in the College Football Playoff Committee's good graces. But if you look at Ohio State and Louisville specifically, they seem like two teams who lost at the exact right time, if we assume that they're going to win out, whereas Michigan might have a problem with how late they lost. I'm wondering if there's even a way to pinpoint, like, when it comes to this particular incarnation of the College Football Playoff Committee with four teams, like, what's the best time to lose if you're going to be a one-loss team?
I think that's probably true. You know, this idea that you want to hide your loss kind of from the prying eyes of the committee, maybe get it in before they release their first rankings, but not the week before or 2 weeks before, but kind of have built some cushion in. I don't know about if we can quantify how much attention is paid to week one, sort of those big national games on the first week, the showcase games versus later games. But I do know that, you know, when we calculate our odds of making the playoff, we try to mimic the behavior of the voters by looking at past behavior in terms of coaches' polls. And they had a pronounced tendency to sort of hold later losses against teams more than earlier losses. So I do think that if you can kind of hide it, it makes total sense that you would want to do it not in the showcase of the first week, but also not late in the season by any means, where you have less time comparatively to make up for it and with voters.
That's where you're exploiting psychology, basically, and where the numbers don't come into play. So let me just finish the top four real quick. We said Clemson, then Ohio State at 54%, Louisville, whom we just mentioned, at 48%. Kate, your Colorado Buffs. They are 24% to win the conference. That's the good news.
Yep.
8% to make the playoff.
What if you have them winning out?
If you have them winning out, they are 26% to make the playoff.
Oh, see, last week I felt like they were 43% to make
the
playoff.
You know what? I checked the wrong box just now. I checked West Virginia's box. Let me do that again and tell you, they are 42%.
Thank you, Chad.
To make
the playoff. I can't believe you swapped Colorado for West Virginia. Why?
They were adjacent. Their check boxes were adjacent.
Wildly different schools.
It's true. Kate, I'm going out to UC next week for Thanksgiving. My parents live out there. Last year I went to a game. I got to check if there's a game again this year.
I think
Colorado is the
fan.
Official hot takedown team, right? I think that's fair.
Neil, do you have any arguments?
Well, I'm partial to Georgia Tech.
That's right. But I don't have a college team, and therefore two against one.
And Georgia Tech has been such garbage in both football and, although we won this past weekend, and in basketball that, you know, I don't have any problem rooting for of the two schools. How about this? We picked the one that is having the better season. By far, that's Colorado.
It is resolved. Kate, as transition chairwoman, get on it. Get whatever swag we need.
I'll have t-shirts and hats for all three of us next week.
All right. Excellent.
All right. Let's leave it there. I'm sure we will return to college football going forward. And now let's move on to our next segment, which Kate Fagan couldn't join. She had to step out. But instead, we have Oliver Rader, 538's puzzle editor and games writer and many other things at 538. Hi, Oliver.
Hi, Chad.
All right. So, Ollie, you are outside the arena for the World Chess Championship right now. Give us a little play-by-play of what's happening inside. Then we'll zoom out a bit and talk about the championship as a whole.
Yeah, we're in Lower Manhattan. The first time the World Chess Championship has been in the United States since 1995. Right now, the fourth game of the best of 12 match is taking place, and it is the defending world champion Magnus Carlsen from Norway is taking on his challenger, Sergei Karjakin, representing Russia. And looks like they just made the 23rd move of the fourth game, and it's all tied up. Tensions are running high, and it's very exciting here, Chad.
So 23 moves of the fourth game. How long has the match been going on already?
So they play one game a day, and I believe it started on Friday. So this is the fifth day of competition, and they'll play one game every day until someone gets to 6.5 points.
And how long does each move take?
Well, it really depends. So in the beginning of the game, these players really know what they call their opening book. So they really have all the opening sequences of moves essentially memorized. So in the beginning of the game, they'll move quite quickly. They'll have a plan from the outset. But when you get to what they call the middle game, it really slows down. So there was one point yesterday when Sergei took over 25 minutes to make a single move.
That's a long time to watch someone stare at a board, Neil.
Yeah, it is. And in this particular brand of chess, is there any, like, they hit the clock, and is there some kind of, like, penalty for taking so long, or is that just kind of the nature of what they're doing here?
Yeah, that's right. They are timed, so they each have their own clock, which runs down when it's their move. But this is what's called a classical time control. So there's speed chess, and then there's this, which you get, I think, 100 minutes at the outset. But when you reach your 40th move, you get a bonus hour. And when you reach your 60th move, you get a bonus 15 minutes. And this actually came into play last night. The game last night took 78 moves each and took almost 7 hours. Wow. So it started in the afternoon and ended at almost 9 o'clock p.m. Eastern time. Despite those 78 moves, the game ended in a draw. But it was an extremely, extremely exciting draw. And you can see my piece on 538 where I talked about kind of the ups and downs and roller coaster that kind of ended, you know, right back where it started.
So, Ollie, give us a sense of the two competitors, Magnus Carlsen and Sergei Karjakin. Are they the two best players in the world, or is this sort of is one of them an underdog that fought his way to the World Chess Championship?
Yeah, so Magnus Carlsen is the very heavy favorite. He's ranked number one in the world. He's the two-time defending world champion, and our simulations before the match began gave him something like an 85% chance of winning. Sergei Karjakin, his challenger, is ranked number 9 in the world, and he earned the right to be here to challenge for the world title by winning what's called the Candidates Tournament. And this sort of things they have in common are, one, they're both very, very young. Sergei became a grandmaster when he was 12 years old. Magnus became a grandmaster when he was 13. And now they're just 26 and 25, kind of the flagship of chess's youth movement and kind of the two first competitors for the world title who are very much of this computer internet chess age.
So Karjakin at number 9 was able to kind of make it through this qualifying tournament. That suggests that he pulled off a few upsets, at least in the course of getting there. Are upsets kind of are they common in chess? It seems like in chess, random chance kind of gets thrown out the window. It's more of a pure skill-based sport, or am I wrong on that?
No, I think you're right. All right, chess is a game of perfect information. There's no noise. There's no randomness. But I think the sort of source of uncertainty is these players get into such intricately complicated middle games and end games where even the very, very best players can make a small miscalculation, which is exactly what happened to Magnus in the end game yesterday. He had what the computers found as a pretty clear winning line. But, you know, he had been playing for 6.5 hours and he missed, you know, what would have been a one game, and it turned into a draw. So I think the uncertainty comes from just how complicated this game that they're playing is.
So does that mean that the computers are still better than the humans, or maybe still is the wrong word to use there? But if the computer saw a line, does that mean that the computer would have beaten Carlsen, or just that the computer saw something that Carlsen didn't happen to see?
So I think this is an unsatisfactory answer, Chad, and I'm sorry, but I think it depends, right? So I think there's little question that computers are generally better than humans at chess. Ever since, you know, Kasparov lost to Deep Blue, it's just been a real kind of downhill slide for humans. I don't think that anyone would argue with the fact that, in general, the best computers are better than the best humans, but that being said, there are still certain aspects of the game, certain very complicated endgames that computers still really struggle with, and where there is some real value add for human intuition.
So, Ollie, tell us what to expect going forward. It's tied so far. Does that mean that maybe the rankings, number 1 and number 9, were misleading? Or could it just be that only Carlsen maybe only needs one win, or Karjakin only needs one win, and they can sort of park the bus after that?
Right. So Karjakin has kind of held serve, right? He's been the underdog, but he's managed to capture 3 draws in a row, which I think for him is a minor victory, really. But that's the thing. Just 1 or 2 decisive games, games in which someone wins or loses rather than a draw, will decide this match. So I think, you know, Karjakin could win one or two games, and this whole the whole thing changes very, very quickly. The other thing is kind of it's the outset of the match, and you might think the chess players are kind of like, you know, boxers at the beginning of the round, kind of testing each other out, testing each other's reaches, maybe not being as aggressive or attacking as they will be in games later on in the match where they feel like they do need to get that decision.
Okay, so Ollie, real quick, the rankings, I understand, are based on, yes, ELO. And my understanding is that the ELO that we use has been for sports stuff has been derived from chess. Is ELO where chess began, Neil and Ollie?
Right. Arpad ELO, the father of ELO, the man that launched 1538 Interactive. he was kind of a mathematician and a chess player, and developed this, you know, system to accurately rate chess players based on purely results. You know, it's purely math. There's no subjectivity in it, and you either win or you lose, and your ELO rating goes up or down. And we've taken that from chess to all kinds of things, to sports and everything else.
All right, Oliver Rader, we'll let you get back to the action inside the World Chess Championship. Thanks for coming on Hot Takedown.
Thanks for having me, guys.
Okay, now on to our significant digit. When a telling number from the world of sports is delivered to us, and we have some sad Hot Takedown news this week. Our stalwart producer, Joe Sykes, will soon be our erstwhile producer, Joe Sykes.
Oh, Chad.
And it's a Hot Takedown tragedy, as far as I'm concerned. Joe has shepherded the show in ways that you listeners have come to love and enjoy. And while we have a succession plan in place, it won't quite be the same without Joe and his beautiful British lilt.
Is this what Kate, the transition chair, for? Is this why she's transition
chair? That's a great point. Yeah. It's really about the producer transition.
We're going to have to interview you afterward, Joe, to get all of your pointers and I should shepherd this.
Are you the Rent Priebus or the Steve Bannon of this transition? Right.
Can I have a different option?
Yeah, sure.
So, Joe,
that's what we're all saying.
So, Joe, let's tell us. We said that we would give you the most British birth possible here. Birth, B-E-R-T-H, possible. So I really hope you've come with just some really gnarly British stuff for us with our Sig Dig.
So I think Hot Takedown listeners might know that I'm a bit of a fan of cricket, and we did actually have one cricket segment on the show while I've been the producer. So now I'm coming at you with a stat that none of you are going to understand.
Lay it on me.
So the stat is 246 for 20.
Is that the number of runs over overs?
It's Australia's worst aggregate score in a test match at home in Australia since 1928-29, when Don Bradman was making his debut.
Oh, wow.
Some
okay.
Hot cricket
Don Bradman?
Trivia.
246 for 20. Okay, tell me what it is. What does it mean?
Should we all take a shot at this?
Yeah, sure. Take a shot.
They had 20 at-bats, so those are like innings. So they got the Australian people came to bat 20 times, and in those 20 at-bats, they scored 246 runs.
That would be a huge number of runs, though.
I don't know, though, you hit it far, and then you run back and forth to that thing.
Isn't it about overs, not about at-bats?
That is basically right.
She has
basically got it spot on. They got 20 outs and 246 runs, which in baseball would be amazing, but in cricket is very, very, very low. And they ended up losing the game by a huge amount.
Because it's only 15 runs per batter.
Exactly, yeah.
How many did the other team get?
It's a little complicated because...
I'm not sure.
So the other team only batted once.
Why?
Wow.
That's not fair.
They got 326 for 10.
Ah, I see.
And now I'm not... This is too in the weeds, people. I mean, just it's a fun, you know.
There's a lot of numbers there.
I like to get at the Australians because I'm British, and so this is the worst they've done since 1928.
Wow.
So that's fun.
That's very fun. Joe, we would not have talked about soccer nearly as much without you. We will not talk about cricket nearly as much without
or
you.
Ever. With or
that
without
I can
you.
Promise.
We'll talk more American football without you. Yeah. No, that's not possible.
But truly, it's been a pleasure. And look forward to hearing your voice on whatever British, UK, international globe-trotting podcast you have in your future.
It's been a pleasure being here. So.
Joe, I think...
We're going to miss you, Joe.
We are going to miss Joe. I think to close out his... regime here at Hot Takedown, he should do the credits.
No.
Joe.
What an honor.
It's only fitting. It's only fitting.
Okay. Thanks to Kate Fagan.
Thanks, Joe.
In Brooklyn, and happy birthday, Kate.
Thanks, Joe. I'm going to miss you.
Can I ask how old you... No, sorry.
I'm 35. Oh. That should have been our sig dig, but fine, we did cricket.
Thanks to Neil Payne.
Thanks, Joe.
Sports writer supremo.
Oh, Joe. I'm going to miss you.
Thanks to Chad Matlin.
Thank you, Joe, for everything.
Our podcast 2-point special expert is Jody Abigan. Production assistance came from Tony Chow and Katie Ferguson, who you might be hearing more of, her name more of on this podcast in weeks going forward. You can email us at podcast@538.com. We'd love to know what you think. Find us on SoundCloud, Stitcher, Downcast, or all sorts of other apps. Actually, do leave a review or rating, though, because we need your reviews. And tell us how much you like the show, and how much you like Neil and Chad and Kate. Theme song's by Mystery Mansion. I'm Chad with Matlin. No, I'm not. I'm Joe Sykes. Talk to you next time.